WRCT, Pittsburgh.
CT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a New York Times opinion piece by editorial board member Jesse Wegman said that debunking Republicans' baseless, self-serving claims of voter fraud was always a fool's game because the professional vote fraud crusaders are not in the fact business. Well, the suggestion of that seems to be that even addressing such claims amounts to giving them oxygen. But there's a difference between airing claims and training a scrutinizing or disinfectant light on them. It's actually really journalists' choice which of those they do. The spate of new election meddling laws proposed in Arizona suggests that looking away is not really the answer. But Trumpers' loss in Arizona could also map a way forward if you are interested in that. Our guest is interested. Stephen Rosenfeld is editor and chief correspondent of Voting Booth, a project of the Independent Media Institute. Also on the show, if you think the little guy is left out of Wall Street deals, well, you're not wrong about that. But are things like Bitcoin the answer? Is cryptocurrency a leveling force, or is it just a different flavor of grift that plays on that not unfounded little guy frustration? Our guest gets at what's new and what's old in this description of cryptocurrency as the people's Ponzi. Sohail Mortazavi is a writer based in Chicago. His recent piece on cryptocurrency appears on JacobinMag.com. That's coming up. We'll get right to it. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. When there are people transparently, fervently invested in presenting election results they don't like as endlessly arguable, ultimately bendable to the will of whoever yells loudest and longest, it's important that there be some evidentiary anchor. But when that evidence is provided, it's still largely up to news media whether or not it anchors public conversation. We are at a moment where corporate news media are unfortunately reflecting A.J. Liebling's view of the press as the weak slat under democracy, narrating more than resisting the overt decision of Republicans to shore up power by suppressing the vote. Beyond all of what ought to be sufficient human rights reasons to talk up the fight for something like democracy in this country, there are also journalistic, interesting stories there to be told. Our guest is on that beat. Stephen Rosenfeld is editor and chief correspondent of Voting Booth, a project of the Independent Media Institute. He joins us by phone from San Francisco. Welcome back to Counterspin, Stephen Rosenfeld.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
When we spoke in early November 2020, Donald Trump had already announced, quote, as soon as that election is over, we're going in with our lawyers, close quote. The contestations, the lawsuits, the big lie propaganda were not unexpected, and yet they're somehow still startling. And an epicenter of that was Arizona, where we read about Trump loyalists demanding something called a forensic audit. That did not go the way that people hoping to convince or confuse a wider audience into thinking Trump really won the state didn't go how they hoped it would. But a lot of listeners might know that upshot, but they might not know why it happened the way it happened. You watched that all up close and personal, and I'd just like to ask you to talk us through it.
Sure. The Arizona Senate's Republicans basically hired people who were known election deniers, and some of them had worked in Michigan to create these reports that claimed that votes were stolen, reports that were basically later debunked. And they went in to try to manufacture a result or manufacture evidence where they could claim that Trump won. What ended up happening was you had some progressives who were trying to go on the inside and work with Republicans and basically convince them and sneak documents out. And that was one of my sources. But you also had some retired election technologists who figured out that they could basically box the cyber ninjas in and show that they really didn't know what they were doing. And the way that they did that was they turned to public records, which are different data sets that accompany different stages of the voting process, and they used them to try to basically rebut and confront the most common false claims or cliches. So if you think about how big lies are built from lots of little lies, a lot of those little lies are these kind of dumb cliches, like 40,000 voters were somehow manufactured out of thin air and ballots were smuggled in while nobody noticed on election night. And of course, they came from China. You know, stuff like that. There's just lots of those types of lies. And they generally are voters were illegal or that local election officials are cheating somehow and they're altering totals or that the machinery is being secretly programmed to steal votes. So anyway, I ran into people who used public records to basically refute these. And it wasn't the media, and it wasn't the Secretary of State, and it wasn't the Democratic Party's lawyers, and it wasn't the election policy think tanks. And we could talk about literally what they did. But the point of all this is they came up with explanations before anybody else. Now, it was after Biden got inaugurated, but they showed, for example, in March, but this could have been done in November, that there were tens of thousands of people who voted for a majority of Republican candidates, but they didn't vote for Trump. And that was several times the statewide margin. And these were basically from the wealthy Phoenix suburbs. But nobody else did that. I could tell you how they did that. And you know, they also found out that there weren't tens of thousands of fraudulent or made-up voters. And they did this by using different public records. And that's because elections have lots of little subsystems and lots of stages. And if you know what you're doing and you know how to work through this data, and these guys, because they were in this industry for years, knew that, they could produce these very focused and simple explanations. So that's what I was reporting on.
Well, I want to ask, there's so many questions out of that, but let me start with the human beings, because listeners may have heard of the Cyber Ninjas, this company which apparently is just shut down, but they were brought in as supposedly election experts. They were people who had no expertise in this, but they were brought in as, you know, Trump dead enders who were basically charged with saying that Arizona had voted for Trump. But against these cyber ninjas, we have the audit guys. And I just love the story of who these folks were and what they did. And if you could just take a minute and say, you know, because if folks Google cyber ninjas, you're going to get a lot of hints. Look for audit guys, not so much. Who were these folks? And then a little bit about, you know, they didn't do something that no one else could do. What they did was something that no one else did.
Right. That's really, really true. And the thing is, you had a longtime Republican election data analyst from Tucson. His name is Benny White. And he ran for recorder, which is the countywide local election official, and he lost last November. And he was the kind of person who always looked at voter lists of were the registered voters, you know, up to date, and then the list of people who actually voted. And he tried to compare that to make sure that there wasn't any fraud going on. There were three of them. He was one. The second was this fellow Democrat, Larry Moore, and he created this company called Clear Ballot. They're the only federally certified auditing company that looks at the digital images that are made after a paper ballot is scanned and uses them to match it with the paper and matches with the final results to see if everything lines up. And what's great about that is you can, using computers, you can zero in on every single vote, on every single ballot, and you can see if it's sloppy and messy, and then you can grab the piece of paper and look at it and fight over the real thing instead of something hypothetical. And then Larry's chief technologist, Tim Halverson, who's an independent libertarian, he was retired also. So the three of those guys knew election records. And what they did was Larry and Benny were talking. And Benny said that he was looking at his race in November, and he was seeing that a lot of people in Tucson, Pima County, which is smaller than Phoenix, he noticed that a lot of these precincts with majority Republicans had an inordinate amount of votes for Biden. But he didn't do anything about it. And all you could do is you could look at the subtotals, because that's how things are actually generated at that level in the election results. But in March, he got together with Larry Moore, and he said, let's really dig into this stuff and go after these ninjas. Because what happens is these guys are coming in, and they're claiming that they're experts. They have no idea what they're doing. And literally, we saw that in the spring. They were recounting the second largest jurisdiction in the country, Maricopa County, which is Phoenix in the suburbs. They were just ripping open boxes and trying to, you know, count stuff. And we're talking about 2.1 million pieces of paper. Anyway, what these guys did was they really methodically, they knew where to look in all these election records to figure out how to debunk these, you know, the small lies that become the big lies. So the first thing they did was they took a look at the final giant database or spreadsheet of every single vote in every single race. So if you think of like a chart that has 2.1 million rows, you know, it's 2.1 million rows deep and it's 800 rows across because you have like everything from school boards to presidents in a giant count, the second largest county jurisdiction in America. What you see on that spreadsheet, which is so critical, is you can see where people did not vote. It's the only record that shows what people did not vote for. So if you know how to do database searches, and these guys knew how to do this, you could figure out where people were voting for a majority of candidates from one party, but not from one person in particular. So they found something like 60,000 people, and this is Maricopa County, Phoenix, who voted for majority Republicans, but not Trump, and about 15,000 people who voted for a majority of Democrats but not Biden. So those are the Bernie bros. And then you can go deeper. You can even figure out, you can't identify people, but you can identify precincts or neighborhoods. So you can figure out where these people live. You can go talk to them.
Right.
So that was the first thing that they did. They came up with a simple explanation that tens of thousands of people who were loyal Republicans voted for most of the Republicans on the ballot but not Trump. Now, that's a non-technical explanation.
Right.
Where all you're hearing from election officials is, trust us, these are, you know, these technical explanations and things like that. Our systems are accurate. This was a different kind of common sense thing. Republicans have been yelling and screaming about voter fraud as a big excuse, made up voters, to pass all these restrictive measures for years. And the parties have the actual data that can prove that it doesn't exist on any scale that affects election results. And they're not using it.
Yeah.
But these guys did. They accounted for every single voter, with the exception of people whose names are kept hidden because they're judge of cops or domestic violence victims. So to me, this was unbelievably exciting and interesting. And it's a template that could be used because, again, the big lies are built on top of lots of little lies. And these little lies are lots of dumb cliches. I mean, what are the dumb cliches? Oh, you know, voters are being made up and somehow, you know, casting ballots tens of thousands at a time. Or election officials are somehow altering totals tens of thousands at a time. Or the systems are being, you know, secretly programmed and no one's watching, even though everything is on video camera, especially after all the Russian hacking in 2016 or the attempts. So this is really low-lying fruit if you're willing to believe or look for hard data. Now, you know, a lot of people are not going to believe this. But I think enough people in the middle who are not cultists on the right or cultists on the left would actually believe enough of this and lower the temperature in the room. But, you know, that's always my hope as a journalist, that, you know, facts matter.
I want to just ask you finally about news media's focus not on those fundaments, but on the kind of shadows on the cave wall. And you address in this recent piece, this New York Times piece that says that, you know, when it comes to these baseless claims of voter fraud, well, debunking them was always a fool's game. And it seems to sort of suggest that giving oxygen to these baseless claims, that somehow that's the same thing as shining a scrutinizing or a disinfectant light on them. And those things are not the same. There is a role for journalists here, but it has to do with facts over narrative.
What ends up happening is that there's a lot of resistance from election officials for a whole bunch of different reasons to having people look over their shoulders.
Yeah.
They're constantly aware of how partisans will take the smallest things and try to blow them up and make it sound like the sky is falling. But there's also this resistance to releasing the data that they have or working with it or presenting it because they're busy doing other stuff and they think that their systems are good enough. And all you have to do is look at all the lawsuits that Trump lost to show that, yeah, they weren't able to prove anything. But you see, as one person said to me, a retired election official who I really admire, he said, that's fighting the last war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the entire election administration establishment is so concerned with cybersecurity. And they've been so focused on preventing hacking and all that sort of stuff at the expense of generating trust. So that the last war is fighting, is trying to stop Russia in 2016, that kind of stuff, instead of the disinformation that's out there, you know, in the age of Trump. Right there, that's the problem. So a lot of these folks don't feel like you can convince anybody whose minds are made up because they're cultists. But the thing is, I'm not suggesting we're going to convince those folks. I am suggesting that there are lots of people in the middle who are intelligent enough to make up their own minds and would welcome quickly produced, easily understood, focused, you know, common sense explanations right after election day. I mean, imagine if in mid-November in states like Arizona, people were able to sort of understand or be shown that, hey, there were tens of thousands of Republicans who voted for most Republicans on the ballot, but not Trump. What would that have done to slow down the big lie? We don't know because it didn't happen.
All right, then we're going to continue this conversation going forward. But for today, we've been speaking with Steven Rosenfeld. His piece, Meet the Trio, Who May Have Figured Out How to Save American Democracy, first appeared on newrepublic.com. You can find the Voting Booth Project and their work at independentmediainstitute.org. Steven Rosenfeld, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
No, thank you so much. It's always a treat.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams apparently lost money on his trumpeted decision to take his first paychecks in cryptocurrency. Adams had proudly announced an intention to make New York, quote, the center of cryptocurrency and other financial innovations, close quote. But media reporting remains respectful, calling Adams' move an overture to the business community, though it has sparked skepticism. The tone is not, in other words, as though a powerful elected official were losing money at the dog track or betting on fantasy football. This, evidently, is not silliness, but some kind of savvy, whether lowly readers understand it or not. If you're trying to understand cryptocurrency, and the crypto in the name sort of discourages that, and its relation to real goods and services, you probably have deeper questions. Our next guest encourages such questions. Sohail Mortazavi is a Chicago-based writer whose recent piece, Cryptocurrency is a Giant Ponzi Scheme, appeared at JacobinMag.com. He joins us now by phone from Chicago. Welcome to Counterspin, Sohail Mortazavi.
Hi, Janine.
Well, I'm not ashamed. I will ask you straight up. The stock market is somewhat opaque, but we understand that it's ultimately linked to things that get made and sold and used. What relationship does cryptocurrency bear to stuff, to cars, to ovens, to sweaters? What is it?
That's a great question. I would probably start by saying, despite the name, these are not really currencies. Bitcoin was kind of started that way, at least in intent. But they really are just financial assets, and they get traded on financial markets kind of in the way that stocks would. But the big difference is that stocks are like legal ownership in a company, whereas cryptocurrencies are basically nothing. They're basically just digital cells on a spreadsheet that people trade back and forth. They're kind of like digital Chuck E. Cheese tokens almost, just in the sense that there's nothing, there literally is nothing underneath any of them. And there are a lot of cryptocurrencies now besides Bitcoin, and many of them market themselves kind of in different industries. But honestly, it's entirely speculative. All of that's just hype, and it doesn't really mean anything. They're basically just speculative assets.
Well, I already understand more than I did before. No joke. But let me just ask you, what accounts for the imagery of cryptocurrency as being pro little guy or even revolutionary?
Well, I think that it's kind of rooted in libertarian ideology to a certain degree. The person who invented the Bitcoin network did so after the 2008 crash, and the white paper for Bitcoin actually kind of says that it's in response to the 2008 crash. And you know, a lot of libertarians, frankly, have like kind of glommed onto this, and they sell it as you said, like as being good for the little guy. But it kind of misses the mark, because the issue with the 2008 crash was that the banking system was underregulated. And this is kind of exactly the opposite. These are people who want to privatize financial markets entirely, because cryptocurrencies, I mean, the one thing they do well is that they are decentralized. They are decentralized networks. There's no central managing authority, at least the Bitcoin blockchain at any rate. In that sense, yeah, it's just like they're privatized money, privatized financial markets. And to me, that's like the opposite of what we want, to avoid another like major crash.
Well, then what is the role of banks here? Or even more importantly, maybe what's the role of federal regulators? Are they just kind of bystanders here?
Yeah, so they've been pretty asleep at the wheel on this whole thing. I mean, we have a pretty non-functioning political system in general. Getting any basic budgetary bill past Congress is nearly impossible. So getting actual regulation through has been really difficult. I know in New York State, there's been some move to regulate cryptocurrencies, and in particular stable coins, which we should talk about in a moment.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like the DOJ has done investigations, SEC, but everything is just like always a little too late. And we haven't really gotten a good bill out of Congress at all so far.
Well, what is stable coin and what role does that play?
Right. So this is what my piece in Jacobin was mostly about. So I feel like most people kind of get that crypto is this kind of like shady thing. It seems like gambling. It seems kind of like a con and probably a bad investment. And it really is all of those things. But my piece was actually homing in, as DOJ and the SEC did, on stablecoins and the Biden administration as well, I should say. And so basically there are two main kinds of cryptocurrencies that are actually in use. And I will get yelled at for saying this because people will say that there's all these different kinds. But really, there are speculative assets like Bitcoin. People are trading on these markets. And then there's also something called a stablecoin, which instead of being like an asset that's traded at different prices, is pegged usually to the price of the dollar. And so the one that people know the most about is Tether, which is issued by a Hong Kong-based company that runs the Hong Kong-based cryptocurrency exchange, Bitfinex. So I know there's a lot of information dumping on you. But yeah, so these coins are pegged to the dollar, and they're basically, they're treated as dollars on exchanges. Because a lot of these exchanges are overseas, real banks don't want to do business with them, and they don't have access to dollars, basically, to facilitate exchanges on their exchange. So these stable coins provide liquidity on bank exchanges. But the thing about them is there's nothing stopping them from printing as many as they want, which is basically what's happening. You have these private companies issuing fake dollars on the blockchain and then sending them out to their own exchanges and doing basically God knows what with them. And there's nothing stopping them from using these fake dollars to buy Bitcoin assets. And frankly, that's basically what they're doing. And researchers have looked into this. There is a class action lawsuit right now. Also, this is all on the blockchain. It's all public. So we can see what's happening more or less. And so what my piece posits is that the entire cryptocurrency market is basically a Ponzi scheme in which these companies are printing fake money to buy up assets and drive up the prices. I get a lot of pushback on this because people will say, well, you know, technically a Ponzi scheme is a specific thing. They're usually like investment funds that lure in investors and pay out new investors with funds from older investors. And the thing about crypto is that everyone kind of understands that's the rule of the game. So that's not really fraudulent. They know it's a speculative asset, a purely speculative asset. The fraud comes in because these investors are buying thinking that prices are being driven by speculation when they're actually really being driven by market manipulation.
I think that's really interesting because there's kind of a double level thing going on, at least with the narrative around it, where it's like, yeah, this is kind of sketch. But, you know, if you get on the roller coaster at the right time and get off it on the right time, the money you'll make will be real money, you know, even if we realize that it's ironically untethered from real goods and services as people generally explain them. But what you're saying is this isn't even tulips. This is something structurally worse.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the thing is people make money on Ponzi schemes too. A lot of people invested with Madoff because they made a lot of money doing so. And so it fell apart.
Yeah. Well, what do you see as a way going forward? It's clear, yes, some folks are making money, absolutely. A lot of folks are also being duped, and then even more folks are being confused, not to put too fine a point on it. But what do you see as a kind of harm mitigating way going forward?
I think the only way going forward is just to ban them entirely. And that's what other countries are starting to do. China's banned crypto entirely. India is about to. Russia is about to. And they all talk about issuing their own state cryptocurrencies, but these aren't going to be the same, kind of all a marketing gimmick. The actual private cryptos are being banned in all these other countries. And I see that as really the only way because, I mean, these are private companies issuing these stable coins. There's no way we can stop anyone in, like in some other country outside of our own jurisdiction from opening exchange, printing their own stable coins, and continuing the Ponzi. Because Tether is not the only company doing this, even though that's the one that gets talked about. There are multiple ones. So, yeah, I think a full ban is the only way to deal with it because there are companies like Coinbase that are banked exchanges. There's like Gemini, Coinbase, a few other ones are mostly based in like the U.S. and South Korea. And these actually are regulated crypto exchanges that do have banking relationships. And these are functionally the cash off-ramp where people are actually exchanging Bitcoin or Ether or whatever for actual cash. And if we close these down, the whole thing will just die overnight. That's really the only way I see out of this.
We've been speaking with Sohail Mortazavi. He's a Chicago-based writer, and you can find his recent piece, Cryptocurrency is a Giant Ponzi Scheme, at jacobinmag.com. Sohail Mortazavi, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
RCT, Pittsburgh.
You've tuned in to Pandemonium, a public affairs anthology from WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. And now, Pandemonium.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon from WRCT, and I'm joined here on a park bench on a beautiful summer day by Carnegie Mellon University professor Brian Junker. Brian, what department are you in?
Hi, Richard. It's good to be here. I'm in the Department of Statistics and Data Science.
Okay. I'm so old that when I went to college, there was no computer science major. There was applied math. How long has statistics always had its own departments?
No, statistics used to be a part of the math department, and that's generally historically how statistics departments get started. Eventually, the mathematicians and the statisticians realize they can't talk to each other very well, and so statistics breaks off and forms its own department. That happened in the late 60s or the 70s at Carnegie Mellon.
Okay, well, we're not here to talk about office politics. We're here to talk about lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Oh man, you really like to offend statisticians when you interview them, don't you?
Well, you know, ever since I was a kid, you know, like reading Mad Magazine and stuff, I can remember there was one joke book about chocolate. And one of the points was how much protein was in chocolate. And here was the stat about this enormous amount of protein. But then there was an asterisk noting the gargantuan amount of chocolate you'd have to eat. I think that's everybody's sort of the lay person's appreciation of statistics. It's like people tell their own stories, making things up with the numbers.
Right. Absolutely true. And in fact, for the last, 30, 40 years, there's been a strong movement toward increasing numeracy for the lay person, just like literacy was a big issue that led to the formation of public schools and things like that. But I will say that, you know, once you become a little bit numerate, that is, once you sort of become a little bit less afraid of the numbers and can interpret them, what you realize is that all those lies and damn lies are equally tellable with numbers as with language. Open the newspaper. Look at what's in the newspaper that's written in English. Listen to, your favorite news channel that you hate. And listen to what they have to say. With no numbers at all, they're equally capable of lying. So it's just learning another language, like learning French or German or Chinese.
People can do so many different things with the numbers. Like one of the quotes you had up on your website from C.H. Combs was, we buy information with assumptions. And those assumptions show up in the numbers that we hear in the news.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. I actually specifically went and refound that quote myself because I wanted to make sure to bring it up during our talk today. It's one of my favorite aphorisms. It really is. Assumptions are really important. What you can collect from the real world, what you collect is facts. You collect data without any context or interpretation. And the way you convert that data into information, first of all, is by organizing it. And organizing it requires assumptions. You have to sort of know what you're looking for when you're organizing the data. And then to actually use that information in some useful way, you typically are trying to make a prediction about the future. And the only way to do that is to make assumptions about how the data was generated and how it'll happen in the future. So, yeah, you have to have raw information, you have to have assumptions, you combine them, and that's how you get knowledge and prediction. And if you have the wrong assumptions, or assumptions that don't fit very well, you make terrible inferences and terrible predictions about what's going to happen in the future.
That's one of the things that, as a statistician, you help your students understand?
Absolutely. I think my specialty and the specialty of a lot of statisticians is building statistical models, which are really mathematical formulations of the assumptions that you need to understand how the data arose or how to make predictions from the data. And that's what we teach. That's a part of what we teach in the Department of Statistics and Data Science, is how to build those models and how to use those models, how to use those assumptions. Whether you're trying to select the best football player to recruit for the Steelers, or you're trying to predict the efficacy of COVID vaccines or whatever, it's all a combination of facts and models.
Or people my age, if you're trying to make your retirement savings last.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that also is a matter of prediction. You're making assumptions about what's going to happen in the economy. Should I take my investments out of high yield, high risk products and put them in something safe, or will I go with the assumption that the economy is going to grow for a while first?
We're talking with Brian Junker from the Carnegie Mellon Department of Statistics and Data Science. And one of the things that has led me to come talk to you, Brian, is just seeing how much numbers are part of the story that Republicans and Democrats and different countries, and it's all part of the story that they're trying to sell to the consumer, to the reader of the news, the watcher of the TV.
Well, absolutely. And I think, historically, and here's a little etymology lesson, if you will. The word statistics is derived from the word state. And really, statistics began as a way of organizing data so that governments could better govern, at least better in the view of the people who were governing. So some of the earliest statistics had to do with understanding how much farmland there was, or how much crops were grown, so that governments would know how much to tax. That has grown so that now we use statistics in the form of summarized data to understand how welfare should be distributed, how Congress people should be distributed across the states, and so forth. So that kind of information, again, whether it's used with good intention or with bad, is a central part of government.
Using information for good or bad, you're making it sound like it's a double-edged sword that anybody can use for any purpose.
Well, that's pretty much true. I mean, tools are tools, and And the goodness or the badness of tools depends on how you use them. You can use a hammer to build a house, or you can use a hammer to hurt someone. It's a hammer either way, and you try to use the hammer for good instead of for bad.
How do educational institutions like Carnegie Mellon, how do they use statistics?
You mean the institution itself?
Yes.
So there is an Office of Institutional Research at Carnegie Mellon. It has a slightly fancier name than that, but that's basically the idea.
As at many universities. Yeah.
Yeah, most universities have that. And they are collecting data about students and about departments and about the functioning of the university, sometimes directly by looking at records that the university is keeping anyway, and sometimes by doing surveys to find out what students are happy with or what they're worried about. Those kinds of surveys happen essentially every year. There's a survey that's given to all incoming freshmen, and then another survey that happens, I believe, at the end of the first year. And then mostly at the department level, there are exit surveys for students who are graduating.
What kind of data are they looking for?
Well, with those surveys, they're looking mostly for example, what students may know or think they know when they come to Carnegie Mellon as freshmen. And then the later surveys often are addressed to questions about what the students have learned while they're at Carnegie Mellon. There may also be questions about, things that are not so much knowledge related, but are related to the kinds of experiences students have had, whether they feel comfortable at the university, whether they feel like they can go to professors to talk about things or other students to talk about things. All those kinds of things affect not only the knowledge that's imparted at Carnegie Mellon, but also the atmosphere of Carnegie Mellon. And like most universities, Carnegie Mellon is interested in optimizing both of those things.
Institutional research and data collection. Obviously, governments do a lot of that, and then it gets repeated in the news media. You see people freaking out about COVID-19 vaccines because of this or that factual tidbit that comes out. How does taking a measured statistical approach help someone understand what's going on in a situation like dealing with whether or not to be vaccinated or those kinds of things?
Well, I think to some extent this is another area in which that idea of numeracy becomes really important. And it's not so much being familiar with numbers, because after all, we all know about the 10 digits and we know how they combine to form other numbers. But it's really understanding something about how experiments are designed and conducted to understand how effective a vaccine is, or to understand what the side effects of a vaccine might be. And I think with something like the COVID vaccine, what's important to understand is, among other things, is that although the process was accelerated relative to other vaccines, these vaccines that have been so effective, the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine and several others, are built on more than a decade of research. And they went through the same rigorous process of experimental evaluation that every other vaccine that is approved by the U.S. government goes through. And understanding that process, even a little bit, is really helpful in deciding whether you're going to do the vaccine yourself.
You used again that term numeracy, which I think of in terms of understanding how the numbers are used. And one of the things that I know some people are freaking out, I'll say, oh, this vaccine is only listed at 75% effective or 92% effective, but they don't go back and look to see what that means. That means even if someone gets a mild case, it counts as a strike against the vaccine. But in general, if you look overall, it's been reducing the virulence of the outbreak. But people just hear that number and it's not 100.
Right. Well, there are no 100s in the world. And that's the other thing that statistics is really helpful in in helping people understand is that very, very few things in this world are completely certain. And one of the things that statisticians do is develop methods for deciding how certain or uncertain a result or a fact is. And the good thing about the vaccines for COVID, for example, is that by and large, they're really highly effective. A number like 92% is an amazing number for a vaccine, especially when what we're considering is the failures, as you say, the breakthrough infections are likely to be greatly ameliorated by the vaccine, by the antibodies that your body builds up because of the vaccine.
We're talking with Brian Junker from Carnegie Mellon's Department of Statistics and Data Science, and as you're talking about this and how people can manipulate numbers a little bit to sort of tell their own story, I think of economics and all the economic models that get built, but they're all built on assumptions.
They certainly are. I mean, I think the thing that economics adds to statistics is thinking more carefully, or at least making thoughtful assumptions about what the value of different outcomes is. And so, we might be thinking about something like opening up an institution for public use that's been closed for over a year because of COVID. And when you open that institution, there are several possibilities. There's several possible outcomes. One possible outcome is that everything is fine and there are no infections and certainly no serious infections. And another outcome is that there are some level of infections, or maybe even one or two serious infections. And each of those carries a benefit or a cost. And thinking about the kinds of trade-offs that one's willing to make in terms of costs and benefits is extremely important. And one does it explicitly every time one walks down the sidewalk or gets in a car and drives somewhere. There are risks involved in driving a car, but implicitly we calculate the cost-benefit trade-off, and typically we get in the car and drive because the benefits are better than the costs. And the same sort of thing has to happen with a vaccine or with reopening an institution or anything like that.
What about governments? I'm enough older than you, Brian, that I can remember, quote, tornado drills. They were really air raid drills. sort of living in the height of the Cold War and Khrushchev putting missiles in Cuba. So through my youth, it was mostly you call someone a commie and that's all you had to do. And now it sort of seems like things are so much more sophisticated that as people fight about political things, they're calling up all sorts of numbers to support their point of view.
Well, that's probably true, although I certainly see a lot of name-calling in the public square now, too, and the name-calling is much more effective than I'd like it to be. The nice part about numbers is that as long as the numbers come with sources, it's possible to verify and decide for yourself whether those numbers actually tell the story that the speaker is trying to tell.
But we've got arguments about whether or not elections were stolen and whether or not the data needs to be audited.
Election data typically is audited automatically as a matter of law or policy by whatever governmental unit is responsible, whatever local jurisdiction is responsible for the election. And I think that what we are seeing with the political calls for additional audits is not so much an interest in establishing facts, but an interest in raising enough dust that it's difficult to find the facts. And of course, that's anathema to anyone who has a scientific bent or a statistical bent, because after all, we want to know what the actual data is. And our best source for the actual data is the election data that was recorded by the local jurisdiction and audited by the normal procedures that the law and policy allows for.
In a lot of states, the county does its own audit, and sometimes the state secretary of state will do a follow-up.
Absolutely right. And those public servants, although often they're, in fact, almost all the time, they're members of a political party, they understand their job to be essentially neutral with respect to party. And that's one thing that's missing in the additional audits that are being called for political reasons. Another thing that's missing is the care with which one would normally do an audit and the reliance on standardized procedures for doing an audit. Just like with an experiment, if you don't do the experiment according to standardized procedures, you can't trust the outcome. And that's true for many of the politically motivated audits as well.
Numeracy, getting people to understand what the numbers really mean. What? Oh my God, we've seen 100% increase in this or that, and we're going from 2 to 4, versus, oh my God, we've seen 100% increase in this, we've gone from 20,000 to 40,000. What are the kinds of things you think are really important for the American public, students at Carnegie Mellon, and anyone listening to the radio, that they need to really be aware of to put numbers that they hear, statistics that they hear, in perspective?
So I think even your example, 2 to 4 versus 20,000 to 40,000, raises an issue which I think is really important to think about whenever we're looking at data or claims about data, and that is, what is the practical significance of the claim? How can I figure out what the practical significance of the claim is? If I can take away whatever emotional content surrounds the claim, in both cases there's a 100% increase, and it may be that one of those claims is made with a great deal of emotion and the other is not, but what one wants to do is strip away the emotion as much as possible and think about the numbers underlying the factor of 2 increase and think, are those numbers practically important? Is an increase from 2 to 4 as important as an increase from 20,000 to 40,000? Well, it depends. You know, it depends on the context of the numbers. It depends on the assumptions that you're going to make about the numbers. These are the things that are really important about numeracy. Everyone knows what numbers are, but figuring out the context and figuring out the assumptions, those are the important parts.
Yeah, but sometimes people don't tell you all that. They just want to say there's been a 100% increase in X, Y, or Z. You know, it's done to fuel political rhetoric, not to increase knowledge.
Sure, absolutely. That's why it's so important to remain intellectually curious, to be curious enough to go try to find something out about the numbers if those numbers appear to be affecting you in some way. It's important to, I don't know, have a little bit of the lawyer in you, to have a little bit of the, you know, let's test this and see if this really is going to work.
We're talking with Brian Junker from Carnegie Mellon's Department of Statistics and Data Sciences. And since this conversation is going to air on a college radio station, here's something that I can remember was a big deal back from my days of working and teaching at the University of Delaware. So, Professor Junker, how much should students trust online faculty evaluations?
Oh my gosh. Do you have 3 hours, 4 hours, something like that? Online or offline, any kinds of evaluations of faculty by students are essentially just like the reviews you see on TripAdvisor or Yelp or anything else. They can be useful. It's not that they're entirely useless. But again, you need to understand the context in which the evaluations are given. And so, as a student, you need to be looking for things that will be important to you about that class or that professor. Sometimes you're interested in an easy A, and so if the evaluations say, this guy gives a duck class, that's great news. And sometimes what you're interested in is really understanding a subject, and so you might be more interested in an evaluation that says, well, you know, this guy was really hard, but at the end I understood. And so you can't look at those evaluations in a kind of a one-dimensional way. The numbers that come out at the end, they may or may not be useful to you, but the text that gives you the context. That seems to be a theme, context here, but the text that gives you a context, that's what's going to be important to students.
I can remember that I was teaching at off-campus professor evaluation sites. You tended to see people who either had an axe to grind or who just thought this was like the best thing since sliced deviled eggs.
Sure, and actually for that reason, it's a bit dangerous to aggregate student evaluations of faculty because, again, you're aggregating over a group where you don't have much control over who's in the group and who's out of the group. And so you may not be able to trust the aggregation very well. On the other hand, if you look through those reviews and you see something that speaks to you about that class or that professor...
In the actual written comments.
In the actual written comments. If you look at the anecdotes instead of the averages, sounds strange for a statistician to say, but but that's the case. You really want to look at the anecdotes and not the averages there, because the averages are over groups that you just have no control over.
Brian Junker, I know you primarily as a banjo player. How has statistics informed your musical life?
Well,
or is it vice versa?
Oh, the answer is yes. Both ways, my goodness. So I have to say that kind of rigorous, curious, testing assumptions kind of thinking that goes into numeracy and actually comes from some past training I've had in mathematics, the pattern recognition parts, all of those things have influenced the way I approach music and the way I think about music. I will also say, in the reverse, playing music, playing banjo and guitar, little mandolin here and there, that has affected how I teach and how I think about teaching, and actually how I think about talking with colleagues, talking with folks like you, talking with professional scientists that I might be consulting with. That idea of performance has really affected, in ways that I think are positive, the way I interact with students and the way I interact with colleagues and consultees and things like that.
Very interesting answer. I know that some people will talk about the mathematics in Bach, but you know, you're talking about the other side too, having it come back and influence your professional life.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's one of the really great things about being open to whatever experiences you have, is that experience in one area may well influence and inform and improve experience in another area. I have to say that's one of the things that attracted me to statistics initially anyway. One of the metaphors of statistics is that it's the crossroads of science, in the sense that that statisticians develop methods and develop models, these mathematical lists of assumptions, maybe to solve a problem in one area, like educational testing. And it turns out that those same models, those same assumptions, those same methods turn out to be useful in a completely different area, like counting the number of people in a population or assessing the success of a online tutoring system or something like that. And so the methods that you use in one area, you bring into the crossroads, you go out another road to another part of science or policy and discover that those same methods are useful somewhere else. You have to be open to different experiences.
As you were talking there, you mentioned counting people. And I know my son worked as a census taker one summer. I think it's pretty remarkable that we still try to do a nationwide census, but then of course there are all sorts of questions about its accuracy.
Well, that's true. We do a nationwide census because it's required as a part of our Constitution. So every 10 years we have to do, and we should do, head count of the population essentially, and that feeds into things like the apportionment of representatives in the House of Representatives and feeds into lots of our other government policies. Accuracy is a really difficult question for the census. There are groups that are reliably undercounted, such as those who are homeless, or whose addresses are not well established. And there are groups who are reliably overcounted, such as those who live in, who have multiple homes and may be moving between homes, you know, their summer home and their winter home, during the census taking. And so accounting for those inaccuracies is an important part of census taking. And actually, it's a part of census work that has been the object of a great deal of political struggle. And one of the reasons for that is that undercounting in particular tends to happen among the part of the population that would be inclined to vote Democratic anyway. And overcounting tends to happen, conversely, in the part of the population that would be inclined to vote Republican. And so there are political reasons for preferring that either you do or don't account for those inaccuracies. And that's been an ongoing debate and an ongoing legal struggle in this country for quite a long time.
I believe X, you believe Y. I say my numbers support me, you say your numbers support you. What's a consumer of the media supposed to do?
Well, you gotta get behind the numbers. You gotta get to the actual facts. The numbers typically are a summary of what the actual facts are. And so either by digging into the sources that produce the numbers or by collecting facts yourself, you got to get behind the numbers. You have to understand where they come from in order to understand what seems trustworthy.
Brian Junker from the Department of Statistics and Data Science here at Carnegie Mellon. That was a great way to end this conversation. Thank you, Brian.
Hey, I've enjoyed it a lot. I didn't bring a banjo, but I know you brought a couple guitars, so maybe after this we can have some fun.
You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. Thanks for listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
This is Eric Harrison enjoying some whiskey before breakfast with Mando Richard. Wednesdays at 11 a.m. here at WRCT Pittsburgh. Drink up, Yinzers.
I witnessed Lauren have a stroke at 30 years old. It seemed unlikely, but I knew I had to react immediately. I called 911. She recovered, and we said I do. A quick reaction can make all the difference. Learn signs of stroke. Visit strokeawareness.com.
Are you ready for whiskey before breakfast? I am. Hey everybody, I'm Mando Richard, and thanks so much for tuning in to episode 2206 of Whiskey Before Breakfast on WRCT Pittsburgh, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, Delaware, WUTC and WUTC HD1 Chattanooga, Tennessee, WKYWLP Kaiser, West Virginia, or Tube City Online Radio from McKeesport, Pennsylvania. Yes, indeed, we've got a wild show for you today. We'll start off on the liquored up side of the family like we usually do. We'll end up on the gospel side of the family like we usually do. And in between, we'll talk about Norma Watterson, who passed away at the end of January of 2022, and have lots of interesting music from all over the folk music spectrum. Well, what you say we get started with the new Lost City Ramblers doing an old Low Stokes song. Prohibition is a failure, right here on Whiskey Before Breakfast.
Prohibition is a failure, as anyone can see, for whiskey is sold in every town in the good old USA. Oh, the policeman will arrest you, he'll lock you up in jail, he'll drink up all your liquor and turn you out on bail. Thank you. I'm going back to Georgia to join the drinking clan, where whiskey's made of red seal lye and sold in old tin cans. Where the men they drink and gamble, and the women quarrel and fight, and the saloons they run wide open, and a man's killed every night. Mountains, they operate the stills. They're true blue to each other. What they say they'll do, they will. They all carry six shooters, shotguns, and bowie knives. And the man who tries to raid them is sure to lose his life. Homebrew most anyone can learn. He takes a can of old malt syrup and an old-fashioned churn. He adds a cake of yeast or two, and he lets it work and foam. And a bottle or two on a Saturday night, he'll sing my home sweet home. We'll have light wines and good old beer in 1933. And if we do not get it, I'm telling you and you, we'll make our old home liquor and drink our old home brew.